My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
For those in recovery, support from friends and family often leads to better outcomes. Here's to those who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. Visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose for information about treatment options and how to support those experiencing addiction.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
For a U.S. Open championship, Bryson DeChambeau now has two, the second at number two.
That putt by Bryson DeChambeau was the back half of just an incredible up and down at 18 to win the U.S. Open last evening. His shot from the sand trap 55 yards away, one of the clutch shots we've seen in a while in major championship golf. But really, that was sidebar to the story, which was not very clutch. Rory, more on that coming up. Good morning. Steve Sands will be with us at 11 to talk U.S. Open. He was at Pinehurst all week long. Chris Miles from NBA TV before that at 10:35. We have a Game 5 tonight in the NBA Finals. I'm wondering why they didn't have that on last night. So why was there not a Sunday night game on Father's Day? I don't know the reason, but they're going to play tonight. Dallas and Luka in particular, outstanding on Friday night to extend this series at least one more game. So Chris Miles will jump on with us at 10:35 to preview Game 5. Boston, a 6.5-point favorite tonight, Denton. I think we're going to get a tight game tonight. Tight game that Boston wins to wrap it up 4-1. We'll see. Ben Standing later on in the show at 12. We'll also on the show today get to a DC sports study that was done. I don't know how many of you heard about this. It was a study used to determine just how viable economically a new stadium and the football team returning to the RFK site would be for the city. Eric Flack from WUSA TV9 has covered this, and he will be with us. You'll hear his thoughts on this. Kind of interesting stuff. But we start, have to, right, Denton, with what I hate doing, but it's the only way to describe it. It was an epic choke by Rory McIlroy over the last hour of the U.S. Open last night. I mean, there's no other legitimate way to describe it. Bryson DeChambeau's 18th up and down is amazing. But for all intents and purposes, he should have been down at that point a shot because Rory McIlroy, arguably the best player in the world for the last 10 years, but hasn't won a major in 10 years, just completely gagged over the final hour of the Open. His mid, if you followed Rory, you know his mid and short range putting has been a culprit over the years for him in some of these majors. But even the biggest of Rory McIlroy skeptics would never have guessed or anticipated what happened late yesterday evening. Up two shots on the back nine at one point after erasing a three-shot deficit to start the day, Rory got to 15 in his march to a fifth major championship, and the first one for him since 2014, just began to slowly crumble. 15 would be the first of three bogeys over the final four holes. The bogey at 15 wasn't even close to what happened at 17 and 18. The bogey at 15 was your conventional run-of-the-mill bogey. What happened at 17 and 18 is just all-time memorable in terms of a choke. He missed a 2.5-foot putt for par at 17. He pulled it. At 18, he missed a 3.5-foot putt for par. You make one of those, and at worst, he's in a mano-v-mano playoff against Bryson. God, I was rooting for that. That would have been awesome to watch. A two-hole aggregate, Bryson versus Rory at Pinehurst for the Open. If he makes both of those, he's a U.S. Open winner for the second time in his career. This was the worst moment of his Hall of Fame career, and trust me, it's a lock Hall of Fame career. It's up there on the list of some of the worst chokes of all time in the sport. Now, if you know anything about Rory, you know the 2011 Masters story, where he entered the final round with a four-shot lead, and he shot 80 on the final day, the highest round of the day, and it fell apart for him at number 10 when he hit it out of bounds, and it was just a triple bogey followed by a bogey followed by a double bogey. It was just a massive meltdown. But at the time, he was just 25 years old, and there really wasn't much history at that point. It was like, the young kid will get over it. He's so talented. And he did, and he won four majors in a short period of time, but hasn't won one in 10 years, and everybody's been waiting on Rory McIlroy to win not just another major, but majors, because Rory was the one that was going to push Tiger, Jack. What happened yesterday was nuts. I'll get to Bryson in a few minutes. Here was what was nuts about it. Rory McIlroy going to 17 had been for this season, for this current golf season, was 496 for 496 putting inside of 3 feet before the miss at 17. And the 17 miss, for you golfers out there, that was a pull. That was really, really a choke putt. The one at 18 was not easy. But it should be for a pro. He's Rory McIlroy. He's number two in the world behind Scottie Scheffler. But if you're a golfer, you know from 3.5 feet, just up, you know, almost a four-footer, downhill with break, left to right break, downhill, super quick. We miss those all the time. He's not supposed to miss it, and he missed it. So you essentially had, over the final two holes, you had two putts missed, totaling about 5.5 to 6 feet. Wow. This was bad, man. And he didn't stick around to talk about it. Not the best look for him, but my God, what he must have felt like in that moment. You saw him as Bryson's playing 18, and he's in that little, you know, area where they put their scores in and sign their scorecard, and he's chomping on a granola bar, and he's watching, but it's just got to be unbelievable what he's going through in that moment. He had his fifth major right there. Two putts. Shorties. Missed them both. I was personally rooting for Rory McIlroy. And I actually disagree to a certain level, I guess, with the narrative that was coming out of the final round. You know, you heard the USA chants. I mean, it's Rory. He's Irish. And Bryson, all of a sudden, people have fallen in love with Bryson here recently. Bryson's undergone a major transformation personality-wise and has become much more popular, much more likable by everybody, according to everybody on the LIV Tour and caddies and other players. By the way, you had that, you know, LIV versus PGA, Rory versus Bryson. That whole thing was going on coming down the, over the last couple of hours. It was actually riveting sports theater. I don't care if you're a golf fan or not. That, especially given the two names that were battling it out. It would have been great to see a two-hole aggregate. My God, that would have been phenomenal. But Bryson's had this major change in the way people view him, and the crowds were into Bryson, there was no doubt. But as Rory was draining one long putt after another until he got to the final four holes, the roars for Rory, I thought, were just as loud. I don't know, Denton, and I talked to Scott about this last night, and I said, are you telling me that if Rory had won, that would have been an unpopular win? He goes, no, not at all. It would have been very popular. But there was legitimate DeChambeau buzz and love, and there was probably a slight edge to DeChambeau. I think the narrative coming out of it was that everybody was rooting for the American. I don't know. I didn't feel that way at all. These golf tournaments, for me, they're not team sport competitions. I wasn't necessarily rooting for the American. I guess, you know, U.S. Open tennis, we get a lot of pro-American rooting, and I get that. But in part because the Americans have not been great other than Serena, you know, on the women's side. But I was rooting for Rory. I did not have a horse in the race. I didn't bet anything. Although, did you see what the Bryson number was before the final round yesterday, Denton? Did you look at that?
It was like minus 125, right?
At one point late Saturday, it was minus 110, which was awfully fishy to me. And I almost thought, I'm just going to take three or four golfers, Finau, Rory, a couple of others. I didn't. It went to a couple of the sites I looked at right before everything started yesterday. I saw it go to minus 165, minus 170. But I thought he was an incredibly short favorite for a guy that had a three-shot lead going into the final round.
But I think that's because that course was just eating dudes alive.
It was, but he still had a three-shot lead.
I thought after the fifth hole, I thought that was the worst the day was going to get for Rory. You know that when he shot that
point.
Second shot.
I have that in my notes right now. The fifth hole was it was the worst luck. I mean, golfers had bad luck all weekend. But this is what, you know, Scott talked about with us prior to Pinehurst, is you can hit a near perfect shot. And then if it misses by 6 inches, instead of making eagle or birdie, you can make bogey or double bogey. That was a perfect shot into that par 5, and it missed by like 6 inches. Not only did it roll back off the green, it would have been better had it rolled into the trap. It didn't. It rolled into that into the waste area, and he ends up making bogey on a hole that should have been at worst a birdie, two-shot swing. Yes, that was bad luck. That wasn't choking or bad play. That was bad luck.
After that, though, I was like, all right, it's not going to get worse for him. Like, that was the worst it's going to get, and then you had that bogey situation on 15, 16, and 18, and you're just like, all right, never mind. Because I did have a dog in the fight. I had Rory. I had him winning without Scottie Scheffler, which is kind of hilarious on Monday, but on Thursday, that was like a real bet you could place. So he just had to win yesterday, and I was not thrilled.
I actually made one wager yesterday. I lied. I made one wager. I had Koepka plus 160 straight up against Scheffler and won that. for whatever reason, I didn't think Scheffler. I think there was a lot. It was total kind of contrarian. I think a lot of people were like, well, Scheffler was going to watch him. He's going to go out and shoot 65 on the final day. And he just looked done to me. Great point on number five, though. I wrote that down. I'm like, what a massive turnaround. You know, if he doesn't win, he's going to look back at that. And at the same time, what Bryson did at number eight, you know, one of the hardest hole, I think, on the front, he's in major trouble and somehow makes par there. That was an incredible save. Bryson had so many big-time saves. I mean, he was his driver. He crushes it. But he missed most of the fairways, including his worst miss, which was on 18. I'm like, you know, from where he was hitting his second shot, where he didn't have a real backswing, where he didn't have a real angle to the green, I'm like, how's he going to hit this? Is it possible he could make double bogey and Rory could win here if he makes double bogey? And when he went in the trap, you know, I don't know, Brandel Chambly and Faxon were talking about, you know, the best he can do is get to a point where Payne Stewart had the putt on 18 and 99, and that, you know, to have that to win the tournament. But more likely than not, it's looking like he'll bogey this 18th and we'll be in a playoff with both of them at 5 under. Which, by the way, remember what Tiger said after the right before the tournament started? He said, whatever the first round low score is, that's your winning score. Remember he said that on Wednesday? And 5 under was the first round score. He missed it by a shot. Yeah, it's a great shot. It's a clutch shot. Look, he's a big-time competitor. He is a big-time talent. He's a bit much at times, to be honest with you, just personal, you know, opinion. He's very wired and, like, you know, he's all over the place, man. He is at 100 miles an hour, 150, even when he's not playing. But he was super classy after the event. There's no doubt about that. And he finished. He had a chance at the Masters, had a legitimate chance at the PGA. He wins this. And I don't think before, correct me if I'm wrong, before the Masters in April, was anybody thinking Bryson's going to win a major this season? I don't think so. And he's been in all three, legitimate shots in all three of the majors. He finished, did he have a top five finish at the Masters? He had a top five finish, right? Finished second at the PGA? Look up the Masters.
I'm looking up Bryson now.
I think he was top five at the Masters, finished second to Xander at the PGA, and then he wins the U.S. Open. Sets up a lot of drama for Troon coming up next month for the final, the Open Championship, the British Open, especially for Rory. Have we heard anything from Rory at this point? Still nothing, right?
Nothing. He got out of there, gave us a good meme, and then got out of there.
What was the meme?
Of him just looking dejected, leaning on the table.
Yeah. He sent that out?
No, you're just saying, the
one that we all saw.
But we captured it, and I've been seeing it used a bunch of different times.
Tell you what, we've set up, you know, for me anyway, just you want to see him overcome this. I was really rooting for him coming down the stretch. He played so brilliantly until everything was right there with the flat stick and two short putts. I know 18, you golfers, even you really good golfers, would say that's not an easy putt. I understand that, but he's number two in the world. Don't you have to make a 3.5 footer, even if it's downhill with break? I mean, and he looked, the one at 17, he just pulled. I mean, that's not a difficult putt. And he just pulled it. Really, really exciting final round. It didn't go the way I wanted. I didn't realize we have not had, I think, a playoff in major championship play for like 10 years. Is that what they said going down the stretch? It's been that long since we've had a playoff and a major championship. It seems like it's been forever. Seems like it used to happen all the time for years. You know, the U.S. Open at one point, well, for forever, up until, I'm going to say 10 years ago maybe, was, you know, when Tiger had the playoff at Torrey Pines. But it was a full 18-hole playoff on Monday. That was the U.S. Open. Then they changed that, I don't know, a decade ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, because, you know, people want to see the thing wrapped up on Sunday. And so it's a two-hole aggregate, which would have been fun to watch. By the way, I don't know what holes they would have played. I'm assuming 17 and 18, more likely than not. Great golf. Really, really fun to watch. I actually, the other guy that I was hoping, and good for him, I mean, he made a really nice run in the back nine, but Finau ended up going, shooting 67, the low round of the day. I think Sam Burns also shot 67 and went 3 under on the back to give himself, you know, a shot. Cantlay had plenty of opportunities too, you know, coming down the stretch. He gave himself a bunch of chances, had a putt, a makeable putt at 18. And 17, if he knocks in, you know, one of those, it's more pressure. You know, the other thing about Rory missing both of those putts, it really, DeChambeau not having to make par on 18, Denton, the fact that he didn't have to make it to win, if he had had to make par to force a playoff, that would have been tougher. He had a stroke to, you know, bogey was going to be worst case playoff for him. I think if Rory makes the putt on 18 and he's sitting there at 6 under and Bryson is in that trap and he's got to get up and down to force a playoff, it's a bit different in that spot. But that guy is big time. There's no doubt about it. He hits it big. He plays big. He's something else. Really is. I mean, mad scientist, no doubt. A little bit manic at times, but he is a brilliant talent. There's no doubt. And everybody seems to like him now. So good for him. Good for him. Great golf yesterday. All right. Chris Miles is going to join us at 10:35. I wanted up next to just quickly talk about a couple of takeaways from that Commander's Log episode where they had all of the cameras for the draft. I thought, you know, Denton brought it up during the show on Friday, and I had not watched it. I had just seen a couple of the clips, and that was it. I ended up watching it. It's 50-some-odd minutes, and I had a couple of things that I wanted to mention as a takeaway or takeaways from that show that I actually thought were very informational, and some of it was new information. We'll get to that next. The NBA Finals at 10:35. We'll come back to the golf as Steve Sands will join us at 11 a.m. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
I'm John Oran, Pucks sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
In life and recovery, every day is a little different. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
What's cool about this moment is this is our third commander. Three guys, three gold tags, three guys that are badasses. Now we get 20 of those out. We're 3 for 3 so far. Let's keep that going.
That was Adam Peters talking about the selection of Mikey Sanristil at number 50 in the second round on the second night of the NFL draft back in late April. And by the way, those gold tags, there were 20 of them. They'd given them out, the three. Apparently, they are essentially tags that they had 20 players graded as kind of the high end of combination of everything, including great culture, great, you know, leader, all of those things kind of combined into it. I surmised after watching it and talking about it on Friday that maybe they were first round grades, but somebody sent me a note from out there that essentially said they were not necessarily first round grades. It was more of a character combined with everything else. A grade that they had. So real quickly, we talked about it on Friday's show, this Commander's Log video, episode 3, which was titled At the Top of the Pile. And the reason it was titled At the Top of the Pile is that Dan Quinn, in describing what they're going to look for in the draft, he discusses competitiveness. And that's, you know, they're looking for competitors. And that's the top of the pile trait that they are looking for. It's something we've heard from him and from Adam Peters literally since the days that they were hired and introduced, that they had a very shared or aligned vision on the type of player traits that they're going to be looking for. And real competitors, guys that really love football, want to compete, high motor, that's what they're looking for. And look, when you think about Peters and where he came from, the 49ers teams of the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, they've just had some badass, relentless, high-motor guys. You know, Debo, Kittle, McCaffrey, you know, Trent. I mean, just, Fred Warner. It's like they just seem to have a lot of those guys, and that's what they're looking for. Anyway, that's why this particular episode of the Commander's Log video, which you can find on YouTube, I think you can find it on their team website as well. It was very well done. Like, it was, you know, after the show Friday, I had a friend of mine that said, just watch it. It's actually well done, and there's some stuff in there that's really interesting, and I totally agree. It was well done. All these teams, I think, are doing them, and they have been. I think this is the second year Washington's done it. It might be the third year. I haven't watched a lot of them, but this is the behind-the-scenes on the draft. And remember, the draft is 3 nights, and it's, you know, when all is said and done, it's probably 24 hours worth of tape they got to go through. I mean, you got 5-6 hours night one, 5-6 hours night two, and then day three is a long day, right? And they edited it down to 50 minutes. So take that for what it's worth based on what I'm going to say to you. But my biggest takeaway was that Adam Peters was by far and away, like, it's not even close how much more impressive he is than everybody else. No disrespect to anybody else. You know, there are a bunch of meatheads in the room. I'm kidding. There are a bunch of football guys in the room. Adam Peters, I think, comes off as the guy with maybe the highest intellect in the room. But then again, it's 50 minutes out of hours upon hours, and this is his show. I mean, he's the general manager. This is his show. He should be the one that comes off as the most prepared, the most knowledgeable. But there's something else about Peters and just watching him in that he's polished. There is, you know, kind of the mind is always working. Like, I get the sense that, you know, he's probably, if not the smartest guy in the room, he's certainly near the top of the list, which is good to know. It's encouraging. Again, could be completely wrong because this is an edited 50-minute video from hours upon hours of stuff. But there were a couple of things that I found interesting in terms of what I thought was kind of informational and we didn't necessarily know. First of all, when they are on the clock at 36 with their first of the 2 second-round picks that they had going into the draft, this was their own pick, not the Chicago pick at 40 for Montez Sweat. This is number 36 overall. This is the thing we talked about on Friday where he's in this back and forth with Howie Roseman with Philadelphia. Clearly, Philly wants to get into a position where they can draft Cooper DeJean. You know, that's the guy I think they wanted. They wanted to continue to add speed to a secondary that was an issue. And, you know, basically, Roseman wants 40, 78, and 152 for Washington for 50 and 53. And, you know, Adam Peters isn't budging. He's like, I'm not walking away with one less pick. You got to give me 161, which is an Eagles fifth-round pick. And Roseman says no. Then he comes back and says, we'll give you 210. And Adam Peters says no. And then finally, Roseman says, we'll do it. So Washington gave up 40. Oh, my fault. 36, first of all. The Johnny Newton pick. I'll get to 40 in a second. I jumped ahead. The 36 pick, they're on the phone, and they don't do a deal with anybody. And it's really clear that they are waiting to see who Atlanta drafts at 35. And they drafted the guy Ruke Orihoro from Clemson. And once they drafted him, Lance Newmark looks at Adam Peters. Peters looks back and says, Ruke, that's who Atlanta took. And then they knew they weren't trading 36. They were potentially going to trade 36 right there to presumably Philadelphia, but Johnny Newton is who they were waiting to see if he got picked by Atlanta, and when he didn't, that was their guy. Also, very interesting to see this board, and when they take Johnny Newton's off the board, he's the highest-ranked three-technique defensive tackle, defensive lineman on their board. It looked like he was almost pretty much their highest defensive lineman on the board. But then we get to 40, which I jumped ahead, sorry. And finally, Roseman says, all right, I'll give you the fifth rounder, number 161. And Adam Peters says, God, you're a pain in the ass. In a fun way towards Roseman. And they do that deal. And then at 50, they take Sanrastil. By the way, there's this joke with Sanrastil about Cincinnati picking right before Chris Jenkins, a defensive tackle from Michigan. And the guy that Peters is on the phone with, presumably with Cincinnati, the guy says, yeah, we're taking the defensive player from Michigan. And it scared the hell out of Peters because they wanted Sanrastil. And then when Quinn asks, Peters jokes with Quinn saying, yeah, they're going to take the defensive player from Michigan. And you can see Quinn's dejected. Then he goes, Chris Jenkins, the defensive tackle. And Quinn is ecstatic. And Quinn says, this is the guy from the moment I met him, I wanted to coach him in terms of Sanrastil. The Senate pick was interesting at 53 because Washington was considering trading back there as well, but they bring Cliff Kingsbury into the conversation, and Kingsbury just goes, look, man, this is you, but this guy is, you know, tough as S. And Adam Peters says, tough as S as a competitor. And then Josh Harris, the owner, who is kind of hovering, you watch this, Denton, he's kind of hovering over the entire operation. I'm not saying that he was intrusive at all. He's just there. I mean, he's the owner, and he's observing, and he's interested, and he's asking questions here and there. But he asks Adam Peters, if we pick him, will he play with Zach on the team, meaning Zach Ertz? And they both, he and Kingsbury, both say, oh, no, we've got room for both of them to play. I thought that was interesting. Like, he's like, well, if we pick another tight end, we just signed Zach Ertz. I mean, where's the room going to be? But he's definitely in the picture for most of this, you know, video, Josh Harris. And by the way, you learn on the Senate pick, by the way, they pronounced it Senat. They didn't know the correct pronunciation. But regardless of that, that athletic profile was really high with Senate, and that was definitely something they were looking for in the draft. And then lastly, I thought that there, before they picked Luke McCaffrey, there was an interesting exchange. The Rams were on the clock at 99 with the next to last pick. Washington picked at 100, which was the pick that they got from Chase Young from the 49ers, with the compensatory pick. It was the final pick of the third round. And the guy that goes to the Rams is Cameron Kitchens, a safety to the Rams, who goes at number 99. And Adam Peters says, well, that didn't make it any easier because they both play the way we want them to play. And I took that as Kitchens and McCaffrey were right there, and maybe if Kitchens doesn't get picked there, Kitchens could have been the pick. I could be wrong. That's just what I took from that, is that he clearly, like, you hear the pick, the Rams pick made, Cameron Kitchens, safety, and he just says, that didn't make it any easier. They both play exactly the way we want them to play, meaning McCaffrey and Kitchens. I don't know. Really, I would urge anybody that's got some time and is interested in that kind of stuff. The behind-the-scenes stuff on the draft is so good, so fascinating, because we just don't really, until we started to get some of this stuff, really understand. It's a bit less organized than I would think, but Peters was organized and prepared. He was, I thought, in this video, very impressive. NBA talk next. Chris Miles will join us. Kevin Sheehan of the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
PGA golf, Bryson DeChambeau wins his second U.S. Open, shooting 6-under. Rory finishes second at 5-under. Scottie Scheffler finished the day. He was the betting favorite coming into the weekend. He finished at 8-over. Not a great weekend for Scotty. Major League Baseball Nationals sweep the Marlins with a 3-1 win. Lane Thomas homer. Mitchell Parker pitched 6 innings and struck out 4. The Nats are now 35-36. They're off today. They start a series with Arizona on Tuesday at Nats Park. The Nats are a half game back of the final wild card spot in the National League. Elsewhere in the National League, Mookie Betts fractured his hand, and he will be out for, quote, some time, according to the Los Angeles Dodgers. In the NFL, T. Higgins signed his franchise tag with the Bengals. He will be reporting soon. And that's what's trending.
All right, tonight we get a game 5. I'm glad. I want to watch more basketball. You know, you hate to see what happened Friday night where it was a non-competitive game, but at least it was non-competitive. And Luka really did bounce back with a nice effort. Joining us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, one of our favorites to talk NBA with, it is Chris Miles from NBA TV. At Chris Miles TV on X on Twitter. Give him a follow. So, I haven't had you on since, I don't know, maybe it was at the beginning of the playoffs. I forget, but I'm curious, before Friday night, what your opinion of was Luka through the first 3 games of the series, and then how you felt after Friday night.
Well, I think for Luka, to me, the turnovers, I believe it was game 2 where he had the 30-point triple double, but also had 8 turnovers.
Yeah, 8 turnovers.
The first game, he had, what was it, 1 assist? And I was like, all right, I don't recall. Like, I had our researcher looking it up, and his, like, playoff career low was 2 assists, and he had done it 1 time before, right? So it was like, man, I've never seen Luka not have any assists in the game, like, where he's not creating shots for others.
Right.
So I thought in game 1, to me, it was all the Celtics. I thought they came out, had a great game plan, threw Dallas off. Game 2, I felt like Luka needed a little bit more help from Kyrie, right? And I think they could have had that game. But game 3 is the one where, to me, they should have won. When I think of game 2, it's like, okay, they made a late game push, and P.J. Washington, like, threw the ball in a backcourt when they were making their run. And,
right.
Okay. But if you notice, when Kristaps Porzingis got hurt, Dallas started to attack the paint
early,
and since the second Kristaps Porzingis got hurt. I want to say it's like plus 50. No, it's more than that now because it was plus 36 in game four. So it was like it's plus 50 over the last two games. But like you also factor in the point in game two when Kristaps got hurt, right? So they're almost like a plus 60 in points in the paint since the moment that Kristaps Porzingis got hurt. And I thought, okay, they got a real chance to just like blow the doors off here. I thought game three was a lost situation for them, that they really needed to get that win. And I actually asked Kyrie after game four, I'm like, do you guys think you can come back and win this series? And he's like, yeah, I really believe that we can.
So, yeah, I mean, in game three, 19 of the first 22 points for Dallas were at the rim without Kristaps Porzingis in the game. And then it got away from him a little bit. But back to Luka for just a moment, Chris. I think one of the big narratives just for those that don't watch a lot of the NBA is, my God, he complains a lot, and my God, he doesn't defend a lot. I think on Friday night, that has to be the least amount of complaining and whining towards officiating that I've ever seen with Luka. He's not the worst defender I've ever seen, and I just think he's not 100% healthy, but he gave great effort. But what did you make of that? And then sort of this focus, he seemed very focused Friday night to not get engaged as much as he typically does. Now, you know, a 45-point lead or a 40-point lead will help in that matter, I understand.
Well, to your point, one of the reasons they built that lead is they held the Celtics to 84 points.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that was Luka challenging shots early. I just remember seeing that. Also, Kyrie defending Jason Tatum a few times. Like, both of those guys are the weaker links on defense. Like, the other Dallas Mavericks players, when they're locked in, play pretty decent defense. But those two guys both stepping up in at the beginning of, and if you know what, let's go back to game three as well, because everyone points to how Luka was interacting with the refs and his defense. If you remember in that first quarter before he sat out with 4:34 to go, Luka did the same thing. He came out playing defense. They were up by 13, and it seemed like they were on their way to the first win of the series. He sat down at the 4:34 mark in the first quarter of game three, and by like the time he checked back in, it was like defensively he had checked out. Now, some of the guys were pointing out, like as we were watching the game, Chuck was like, do you see his legs? His legs are dead, even on offense. So when he would drive, he's like looking for fouls instead of trying to score. Whereas in game four, he looked at least a little bit more lively, right, where he wasn't just trying to draw fouls. So I think that's another indication to your point. Like, game three is just one of the worst games that we've seen from him, you know, in his first time fouling out in a playoff game. And he just seemed like he didn't have any legs underneath him in that game.
Talking to Chris Miles. So you've watched this forever. I have too. And you get these games like you got on Friday night. And sometimes they are an indication of something, but often they're just aberrations in the better team, which I think we saw through the first three games, goes on and takes game five and ends the thing. Now, your point about Porzingis and the difference without him in there is a factor here, but what do you think Friday night was? An indication that we got a series potentially starting tonight, or just one of those where Boston got down early, checked out, and said, we'll get them on Monday night?
Well, to me, we've had a series all along. I mean, the games have been close, right? Like, when Luka fouled out, don't forget that was still a two-point game with under 2 minutes to go.
Yeah, so they had rallied from – it was a 21-point deficit that they erased, yes.
Yeah,
but
and that happens in the NBA, right? Like,
yes, it does.
We see that all the time.
Right.
Yeah, right. So when we look at it, you go, oh, is this – yeah, this – so that same game, you're like, oh, it was a 21-point deficit. Well, they were also up 13 that same game.
Right.
Right. So I look at it like every game in this series besides game four was absolutely competitive. Like, you're watching it like, all right, I think Boston's going to win, but Dallas is in it. To see Boston come out and look so discombobulated, I do wonder how much this finals MVP talk is in these guys' head, right? Like, so we had Jason Tatum on set, and he made it seem like it wasn't a big deal. But if you watch how they played, even at the end of game three, it seemed as if, like, Jaylen Brown was like, yeah, I'm like this, I'm going to win this finals MVP, like taking the big shots, making the jumpers, and like the way that he was playing. But if you look at game four, they came out and it looked like Tatum was like gunning for it a bit. So I wonder how much like something like that is factoring into the equation. None of those guys will say publicly that that's even in their head, but I think that plays to Dallas's like ability to be able to stay in this and get back in this. Is that, look, they know that if they win a championship, Luka Doncic is your finals MVP, right? Like, they know that. And everybody else has kind of just settled into their roles. Whereas you look at what the Celtics are doing second half of games, you kind of wonder, like, all right, are they going to self-destruct with this, like, that old selfishness that this duo had? The only time we saw it was, like, the end of game three and the beginning of game four. So maybe that's nipped in the bud and they just play great basketball and they win. But man, if this gets to game six in Dallas, I think all the pressure is on Boston at that point.
That's really interesting. That would never have occurred to me that there's a battle going on. First of all, through the first three games, to me, it wasn't even close. Jaylen Brown had the series ended after three games, and it didn't. Was your MVP? You agree with that, right?
100%.
Okay. It just strikes me as Jason Tatum is more selfless than a lot of the stars that this may have rubbed or pushed or influenced their play, an MVP vote, an MVP trophy to go along with it. Like, I'm trying to think of recent winners. Like, obviously, there was nobody in competition with Joker last year. Nobody in contention with Giannis a few years ago. Nobody in contention. Well, I guess Steph, there was competition with Steph a couple of times. I mean, hell, Iguodala won it one year, which I thought was ridiculous personally.
To that point,
yeah.
One of the biggest questions, you know, when I had the opportunity to interview Steph, hey, how much does like the finals MVP mean to you? Because it did. It meant everything to him, right? Like, that's the one thing that he kind of felt like people would not give him credit for as a champion, and he hadn't won a finals MVP. And if you look at guys, all these guys, look, if you've ever heard Sean Marion talk about it, they all want to be in the Hall of Fame. Jason Tatum's going to the Hall of Fame, right? Like, if he's finals MVP, not the finals MVP, if he wins an MVP, if he doesn't, he's having a Hall of Fame career. Jaylen Brown, what's really interesting, is on the cusp, but like a finals MVP would almost guarantee that he gets in, right? And without that, you're like, well, what's your big thing? Like, what? How many All-NBAs? How many All-Stars? So I think for Jaylen Brown, it does seem like it means more to him.
What do you think it means to Jason Tatum? Because he strikes me as somewhat selfless, and he just wants to get a ring, which is, I think, more important for somebody like Jason Tatum than the ring and the MVP. It'd be nice to get both, but you want to be on a championship team. This sport is judged. Individuals are judged based on rings.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll tell you this. So we had Tatum sit down on a set, right?
Uh-huh.
And I asked him about the championship ring, and he looks right at Charles Barkley, you know, and the disappointment of not winning,
right?
Right, and being there in 2022 and being so close, and he says like it's everything just to be here. I don't care about the stats, and like I believe him, but there's something watching them on the court at the end of games and the execution where I'm like, maybe he tells himself that, he convinces himself that, and they get in the moment and he still feels a certain way. And when I watch him play, it's different than the things that he says, right? At like the end of the game when those two guys are going back and forth. But everything he says is the right thing. I think he believes it. But man, the proof is on the court sometimes, you know? And maybe he's just had so much experience with interviews that he knows how to say the right thing.
You know, this series has been interesting from this perspective, Chris. It's like going into it, big opportunity for Jason Tatum to finally get a ring. Can he do it? Is he really the alpha, or is it Jaylen Brown? He was the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. After game two, it was all about Kyrie Irving going to game three after two porous two games. And then after game three, it's all about Luka going into game four. And now, you know, coming into game five tonight in Boston, it might be back. It might be about Tatum tonight. You know, if they're going to – well, look, it's – they've already proven that they don't need him to get 30-plus to win. So, like, who is it about tonight?
To me, it's about Kristaps Porzingis, right? Like, they said he was available for game four. He didn't sniff the court.
Right.
If he can come back on the floor and kind of be how he was at the beginning of game one, I think the series is over. If he can't play at all, I like Dallas. And I like that to be
You like him to win the series or you like him to extend it tonight?
First of all, if you remember when you asked me in the first round, I was like, if I had to put money on it, I'm putting a Dallas, right?
Yeah.
It's such an uphill battle that it's kind of like silly to say, oh, I think they're going to win it. No team in history has ever done it. Only four teams have forced a game seven, right? Like, these things are real for a reason. But I think the Kristaps Porzingis injury is similar to the Andrew Bogut injury in Golden State. Like, everyone talks about, oh, Draymond Green and the kick. And that. It's Andrew Bogut for me. Like, when he got hurt, the Cavs just went right at the Warriors that year and attacked the paint, and there was no answer for that. And you see that in this series. It's playing out in a similar way where the Mavs are like, okay, there's no one. Like, there's what? Xavier Tillman, right, to protect
right.
Like, what is that? They're just Al Horford's 38. Like, there's no one. Jaylen Brown is blocking the most shots. So I think if the Mavs keep that mentality and also, force Boston to take contested threes, which they have all series, their defensive game plan has been decent, but it was just spectacular in game four. I think also Dallas negates what Boston is doing to something, like, very nuanced there. Like, Boston is fighting through screens, not giving up open threes, and for Dallas, they're taking less threes and driving to the paint, and that's been working for them. And that's what they need to keep doing. But with Kristaps on the floor, they can't do it as effectively.
By the way, you're talking about Bogut in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm just because that's the Draymond, you know, gets suspended from game five. And Cleveland.
Yeah, when the Cavs came back from being down.
Yeah, from 3-1.
Yeah.
That's an interesting comp because it's more of a role player and more of a player off the bench. And, like, you know, the injury that look, I'm the biggest Kawhi Leonard fan in Toronto in 2019. It's such a great run, but they didn't face Golden State with Durant. So, you know, you got that. All right. So you like Dallas tonight. You like him to win outright.
I think as long if Kristaps Porzingis cannot play and if he's ineffective, I think we could witness something historic here.
Okay.
That's what I think. I think it's that big of an impact because of that nuance of the game. And I look at this should be a 2-2 series. So I don't look at it as Boston dominated and we're up 3-0. I look at it as, man, Dallas made some mistakes at the end of game three that they shouldn't have. And game two, they were right in it as well, even though Luka had 8 turnovers and Kyrie didn't play well. Yeah, I think that if Kristaps Porzingis is not on the floor, that this could be a historic comeback for the Dallas Mavericks.
All right, last one, just because you work with him and you get to watch games with those guys. But for those that missed this, Charles Barkley over the weekend said the upcoming year, which will be, I think, the last of on TNT anyway, for inside the NBA, he says will be his last year on television. Do you believe him?
Well, considering that we're sitting there on the set in commercial break and he says, hey, Chris, I got something to say. And I go, sure, man. Yeah, I'm going to let you take the last segment we got here. And I start messing with him. He's like, hey, don't mess around. I'm going to punch you in your head. Right. Like, considering how serious he said that, some of the other things that he did the previous 3 days leading up to that moment. And we got to talk after the show for 3 hours at the bar, and I am thoroughly convinced that this is what he wants to do. Now, everyone else is going to keep gunning for him, right? Amazon, NBC. But his point was he doesn't want to answer any more questions about it. He's not taking any more interviews. He's done talking about it. I think at worst he's going to take a year off after the last year of Inside the NBA, which hasn't been officially announced yet, right? But that feels like an official announcement.
Yep.
And then I think he'll reevaluate because I think he loves doing TV, loves talking about basketball, but it does seem like this is heartbreaking for him and he needs a break.
Always good to catch up. Thanks for your insight. Hope you're well. And who knows, maybe we'll be talking later in the week with a series or next week after it concludes. I hope you're right. I'd like to see you keep. I want to see more basketball. Thanks, Chris. All right. Looks like we lost him there at the perfect time. We were done. Chris Miles, everybody, from NBA TV. Steve Sands next.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in-store or at mybobs.com to play now.
In life and recovery, every day is a little different. Embrace the good days, the not-so-good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, tonight we get a game five. I'm glad. I want to watch more basketball. You know, you hate to see what happened Friday night where it was a non-competitive game, but at least it was non-competitive. And Luka really did bounce back with a nice effort. Joining us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, one of our favorites to talk NBA with, it is Chris Miles from NBA TV, at Chris Miles TV on X on Twitter. Give him a follow. So I haven't had you on since, I don't know, maybe it was at the beginning of the playoffs. I forget. But it did. I'm curious, before Friday night, what your opinion of was Luka through the first three games of the series, and then you how you felt after Friday night?
Well, I think for Luka, to me, the turnovers, I believe it was game two where he had the 30-point triple-double but also had eight turnovers.
Yeah, eight turnovers.
And the first game, he had, what was it, one assist, and I was like, all right, I don't recall. Like, I had our researcher looking it up, and his, like, playoff career low was two assists, and he had done it one time before, right? So it was like, man, I've never seen Luka not have any assists in the game, like where he's not creating shots for others.
Right.
So I thought in game one, to me, it was all the Celtics. I thought they came out, had a great game plan, threw Dallas off. Game two, I felt like Luka needed a little bit more help from Kyrie, right? And I think they could have had that game. But game three is the one where, to me, they should have won. When I think of game two, it's like, okay, they made a late game push, and P.J. Washington like threw the ball in a backcourt when they were making their run. And,
right.
Okay, but if you notice, when Kristaps Porzingis got hurt, Dallas started to attack the paint
early.
And since the second Kristaps Porzingis got hurt, I want to say it's like plus 50, Well, no, it's more than that now because it was plus 36 in game four. So it was like it's plus 50 over the last two games. But, like, you also factor in the point in game two when Kristaps got hurt, right? So they're almost like a plus 60 in points in the paint since the moment that Kristaps Porzingis got hurt. And I thought, okay, they got a real chance to just, like, blow the doors off here. I thought game three was a lost situation for them, that they really needed to get that win. And I actually asked Kyrie after game four, I'm like, do you guys think you can come back and win this series? And he's like, yeah, I really believe that we can.
So, yeah, I mean, in game three, 19 of the first 22 points for Dallas were at, you know, at the rim without Kristaps Porzingis in the game. And then it got away from him a little bit. But back to Luka for just a moment, Chris. I think one of the big narratives just for those that don't watch a lot of the NBA is, my God, he complains a lot, and my God, he doesn't defend a lot. I think on Friday night, that has to be the least amount of complaining and whining towards officiating that I've ever seen with Luka. He's not the worst defender I've ever seen, and I just think he's not 100% healthy, but he gave great effort. But what did you make of that? And then sort of this focus, he seemed very focused Friday night to not get engaged as much as he typically does. Now, you know, a 45-point lead or a 40-point lead will help in that matter, I understand.
Well, to your point, one of the reasons they built that lead is they held the Celtics to 84 points.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that was Luka challenging shots early. I just remember seeing that. Also, Kyrie defending Jason Tatum a few times. Like, both of those guys are the weaker links on defense. Like, the other Dallas Mavericks players, when they're locked in, play pretty decent defense. But those two guys both stepping up in at the beginning of, and if you know what, let's go back to game three as well, because everyone points to how Luka was interacting with the refs and his defense. If you remember in that first quarter before he set out with 4:34 to go, Luka did the same thing. He came out playing defense. They were up by 13, and it seemed like they were on their way to the first win of the series. He sat down at the 4:34 mark in the first quarter of game three, and by like the time he checked back in, it was like defensively he had checked out. Now, some of the guys were pointing out, like as we were watching the game, Chuck was like, do you see his legs? His legs are dead, even on offense. So when he would drive, he's like looking for fouls instead of trying to score. Whereas in game four, he looked at least a little bit more lively, right, where he wasn't just trying to draw fouls. So I think that's another indication to your point. Like, game three is just one of the worst games that we've seen from him, you know, in his first time fouling out in a playoff game. And he just seemed like he didn't have any legs underneath him in that game.
Talking to Chris Miles. So you've watched this forever. I have too. And you get these games like you got on Friday night. And sometimes they are an indication of something, but often they're just aberrations in the better team, which I think we saw through the first three games, goes on and takes game five and ends the thing. Now, your point about Porzingis and the difference without him in there is a factor here, but what do you think Friday night was? An indication that we got a series potentially starting tonight, or just one of those where Boston got down early, checked out, and said, we'll get them on Monday night?
Well, to me, we've had a series all along. I mean, the games have been close, right? Like, when Luka fouled out, don't forget that was still a two-point game with under 2 minutes to go.
Yeah, so they had rallied from – it was a 21-point deficit that they erased, yes.
Yeah,
but
and that happens in the NBA, right?
Like, yes, it does.
We see that all the time.
Right.
Yeah, right. So when we look at it, you go, oh, is this – yeah, this – so that same game, you're like, oh, it was a 21-point deficit. Well, they were also up 13 that same game.
Right.
Right. So I look at it like every game in this series besides game four was absolutely competitive. Like, you're watching it like, all right, I think Boston's going to win, but Dallas is in it. To see Boston come out and look so discombobulated, I do wonder how much this finals MVP talk is in these guys' head, right? Like, so we had Jason Tatum on set, and he made it seem like it wasn't a big deal. But if you watch how they played, even at the end of game three, it seemed as if, like, Jaylen Brown was like, yeah, I'm going to win this finals MVP, like, taking the big shots, making the jumpers, and, like, the way that he was playing. But if you look at game four, they came out and it looked like Tatum was like gunning for it a bit. So I wonder how much like something like that is factoring into the equation. None of those guys will say publicly that that's even in their head. But I think that plays to Dallas's like ability to be able to stay in this and get back in this. Is that, look, they know that if they win a championship, Luka Doncic is your finals MVP, right? Like, they know that. And everybody else has kind of just settled into their roles. Whereas you look at what the Celtics are doing second half of games, you kind of wonder, like, all right, are they going to self-destruct with this, like, that old selfishness that this duo had? The only time we saw it was, like, the end of game three and the beginning of game four. So maybe that's nipped in the bud and they just play great basketball and they win. But man, if this gets to game six in Dallas, I think all the pressure is on Boston at that point.
That's really interesting. That would never have occurred to me that there's a battle going on. First of all, through the first three games, to me, it wasn't even close. Jaylen Brown, had the series ended after three games, and it didn't, was your MVP. You agree with that, right?
100%.
Okay. It just strikes me as Jason Tatum is more selfless than a lot of the stars that this may have rubbed or pushed or influenced their play, an MVP vote, an MVP trophy to go along with it. Like, I'm trying to think of recent winners. Like, obviously, there was nobody in competition with Joker last year. Nobody in contention with Giannis a few years ago. Nobody in contention. Well, I guess Steph, there was competition with Steph a couple of times. I mean, hell, Iguodala won it one year, which I thought was ridiculous personally.
To that point,
yeah.
One of the biggest questions, you know, when I had the opportunity to interview Steph, hey, how much does like the finals MVP mean to you? Because it did. It meant everything to him, right? Like, that's the one thing that he kind of felt like people would not give him credit for as a champion, that he hadn't won a finals MVP. And if you look at guys, all these guys, look, if you've ever heard Sean Marion talk about it, they all want to be in the Hall of Fame. Jason Tatum's going to the Hall of Fame, right? Like, if he's finals MVP, not the finals MVP, if he wins an MVP, if he doesn't, he's having a Hall of Fame career. Jaylen Brown, what's really interesting, is on the cusp, but like a finals MVP would almost guarantee that he gets in, right? And without that, you're like, well, what's your big thing? Like, how many All-NBAs, how many All-Stars? So I think for Jaylen Brown, it does seem like it means more to him.
What do you think it means to Jason Tatum? Because he strikes me as somewhat selfless, and he just wants to get a ring, which is, I think, more important for somebody like Jason Tatum than the ring and the MVP. It'd be nice to get both, but you want to be on a championship team. This sport is judged. Individuals are judged based on rings.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll tell you this. So we had Tatum sit down on a set, right?
Uh-huh.
And I asked him about the championship ring, and he looks right at Charles Barkley, you know? And the disappointment of not winning,
right?
And being there in 2022 and being so close, and he says, like, it's everything just to be here. I don't care about the stats. And, like, I believe him. But there's something watching them on the court at the end of games and the execution where I'm like, maybe he tells himself that, he convinces himself that, and they get in the moment and he still feels a certain way. And when I watch him play, it's different than the things that he says, right? At like the end of the game when those two guys are going back and forth. But everything he says is the right thing. I think he believes it. But man, the proof is on the court sometimes, you know? And maybe he's just had so much experience with interviews that he knows how to say the right thing.
You know, this series has been interesting from this perspective, Chris. It's like going into it, big opportunity for Jason Tatum to finally get a ring. Can he do it? Is he really the alpha, or is it Jaylen Brown? He was the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. After game two, it was all about Kyrie Irving going to game three after two porous two games. And then after game three, it's all about Luka going into game four. And now, you know, coming into game five tonight in Boston, it might be about Tatum tonight. You know, if they're going to – well, look, it's – they've already proven that they don't need him to get 30-plus to win. So, like, who is it about tonight?
To me, it's about Kristaps Porzingis, right? Like, they said he was available for game four. He didn't sniff the court.
Right.
If he can come back on the floor and kind of be how he was at the beginning of game one, I think the series is over. If he can't play at all, I like Dallas, and I like that to be.
You like him to win the series, or you like him to extend it tonight?
First of all, if you remember when you asked me in the first round, I was like, if I had to put money on it, I'm putting a Dallas, right?
Yeah.
It's such an uphill battle that it's kind of like silly to say, oh, I think they're going to win it. No team in history has ever done it. Only four teams have forced a game seven, right? Like, these things are real. For a reason. But I think the Kristaps Porzingis injury is similar to the Andrew Bogut injury in Golden State. Like, everyone talks about, oh, Draymond Green and the kick, and that it's Andrew Bogut for me. Like, when he got hurt, the Cavs just went right at the Warriors that year and attacked the paint, and there was no answer for that. And you see that in this series. It's playing out in a similar way where the Mavs are like, okay, there's no one. Like, there's what? Xavier Tillman, right, to protect.
Right.
Like, what is that? They're just Al Horford's 38. Like, there's no one. Jaylen Brown is blocking the most shots. So, I think if the Mavs keep that mentality and also, force Boston to take contested threes, which they have all series, their defensive game plan has been decent, but it was just spectacular in game four. I think. Also, Dallas negates what Boston is doing. There's something like very nuanced there. Like, Boston is fighting through screens, not giving up open threes. And for Dallas, they're taking less threes and driving to the paint. And that's been working for them. And that's what they need to keep doing. But with Kristaps on the floor, they can't do it as effectively.
By the way, you're talking about Bogut in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm just because that's the Draymond, you know, gets suspended from game five and Cleveland.
Yeah, when the Cavs came back from being down.
Yeah, from 3-1.
Yeah,
yeah. That's an interesting comp because it's more of a role player and more of a player off the bench. And, like, you know, the injury that look, I'm the biggest Kawhi Leonard fan in Toronto in 2019. It's such a great run, but they didn't face Golden State with Durant. So, you know, you got that. All right. So you like Dallas tonight. You like him to win outright.
I think as long if Kristaps Porzingis cannot play and if he's ineffective, I think we could witness something historic here.
Okay.
That's what I think. I think it's that big of an impact because of that nuance of the game. And I look at this, this should be a 2-2 series. So I don't look at it as Boston dominated and we're up 3-0. I look at it as, man, Dallas made some mistakes at the end of game three that they shouldn't have. And game two, they were right in it as well, even though Luka had 8 turnovers and Kyrie didn't play well. Yeah, I think that if Kristaps Porzingis is not on the floor, that this could be a historic comeback for the Dallas Mavericks.
All right, last one, just because you work with him and you get to watch games with those guys. But for those that missed this, Charles Barkley over the weekend said the upcoming year, which will be, I think, the last of on TNT anyway for inside the NBA, he says will be his last year on television. Do you believe him?
Well, considering that we're sitting there on the set in commercial break and he says, hey, Chris, I got something to say. And I go, sure, man, yeah. I'm going to let you take the last segment we got here. And I start messing with him. He's like, hey, don't mess around. I'm going to punch you in your head, right? Like, considering how serious he said that, some of the other things that he did the previous 3 days leading up to that moment, and we got to talk after the show for 3 hours at the bar, and I am thoroughly convinced that this is what he wants to do. Now, everyone else is going to keep gunning for him, right? Amazon, NBC. But his point was he doesn't want to answer any more questions about it. He's not taking any more interviews. He's done talking about it. I think at worst he's going to take a year off after the last year of inside the NBA, which hasn't been officially announced yet, right? But that feels right. like an official announcement.
Yep.
And then I think he'll reevaluate because I think he loves doing TV, loves talking about basketball, but it does seem like this is heartbreaking for him and he needs a break.
Always good to catch up. Thanks for your insight. Hope you're well. And who knows, maybe we'll be talking later in the week with a series or next week after it concludes. I hope you're right. I'd like to see you keep – I want to see more basketball. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Chris. All right. Looks like we lost him there at the perfect time. We were done. Chris Miles, everybody, from NBA TV. Steve Sands next.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
I'm John Aran, Pucks sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Norsides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Nor Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit nor.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
In life, some days are good, and some could be better. The same is true for recovery. Both take work. Both take adjustments. Finding your path is a key part of your journey. And then it's all about walking it every day. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Be open to every part of the journey and welcome it. It's unique and it's all part of you. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.